As a trauma survivor, I have always been interested in resilience. But growing up, I believed it was something that you were born with. Then in graduate school, I learned that it was a quality that we all possess and a set of skills we can all strengthen. Most of my resilience has come from writing and seeing myself in new ways by confronting the stories I've always told myself. The more I did that, the stronger I became, and I've dedicated my life to helping others do this work. This podcast is for anyone who wants to understand their story and how to revise it, because when we do that work, we change the world. I met Lenny Echterling in 2009 when I entered the graduate program in counseling psychology at James Madison University. In fact, Lenny's work in crisis intervention was one of the reasons why I chose this program. Lenny has more than 40 years of experience in promoting resilience, particularly during crises and disasters. He's worked with landmine survivors in the Middle East and has served as a crisis counselor, consultant, and trainer following some of the world's biggest disasters, including hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the tsunami in India, the 9/11 attack at the Pentagon, and the shooting at Virginia Tech, just to name a few. Yet despite the heavy work he's done, Lenny has remained a lighthearted, gentle, and compassionate man who's as quick to tell a joke as he is to sit with you through your darkest hour. During the 3 years when I worked with Lenny, he supervised my graduate assistantship and EDS project and served as my mentor. Like many of the people who graduate from this program, I'm also honored to call Lenny my friend. To learn more about the numerous things Lenny has done around the globe to promote resilience, please see the show notes. Before we get to our conversation, I have a few questions for you. Have you ever been a victim of toxic positivity or felt like people have dismissed your pain? Has being dismissed made it more difficult to trust others? Have you heard the word post-traumatic growth and wondered what it means? In what ways have you grown as a result of the challenges you faced? I hope you'll ponder these questions as you listen along. Now, let's get to my conversation with Lenny Echterling. Hey writers, have you struggled to develop characters beyond a laundry list of physical traits, or do you fall into the tired cliches of stomachs that roil and boil, hearts that pound, and characters that look off into the distance, unsure what to do? Has a critique partner ever told you your character's motivations or actions don't make sense? Or worse, has an agent told you they just don't connect with your main character? Let's face it, developing great characters is hard work. It takes both artistry and an understanding of psychology to bring them to life and make their actions understandable. It's even harder when that character you're trying to describe is you. That's why I'm teaming up with Jane Friedman to teach the psychology of character development for memoirists on June 19th, 2024. During this 90-minute webinar, you'll discover the three-step chain of events that determines what your character does in any situation. Investigate the role that core wounds, attachment styles, and inner resources play in shaping your character's personality, and find out how having your character act as if can help you limit backstory and start in the right place. Plus, you're going to learn so much more. Best of all, this webinar is only $25. You heard that right, $25. For that price, you can attend the live webinar, watch the recording, or do both, and get access to the webinar's workbook and my slides. So if you want to understand yourself better, write characters readers will fall in love with, and feel confident that you know how to do more than just craft tired cliches, go to janefriedman.com and click on paid classes, or make it easy on yourself and click on the link in the show notes. Well, hello, Lenny. I am so glad that you are here on the Writing Your Resilience podcast. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so glad to see you.
Me as well. It is such a gift to be in your presence. And just before I hit the record button, we were talking about how long we've known each other. And we met in 2009, which is 15 years ago. I can't believe it.
Yes. And I still remember so many times. Well, you worked for me too. You were
right.
Not a student, but you were a graduate assistant. And then working with you on your EDS research project, which was a pleasure to read and to work with you on. And so it's been wonderful to keep in touch over the years.
Well, and you know, the work that I did on my EDS project, and since people are now going to be wondering, A, what is an EDS project? And B, what did you do? An EDS project is an educational specialist degree project, kind of like a dissertation. It would say dissertation light. Does that sound like a good way to describe it?
Well, probably not when you're in the middle of doing it. It doesn't feel light at all.
That is very true. It does not. So I was working on that to get my degree, and I worked on some suicide prevention walks. And we were looking at how do you build these in a very resilient way. And you know, a lot of the work that I did for those walks and as a part of that program really serves as the foundation for everything I do now and for this podcast.
That's wonderful. That's great to hear.
So I bring everything I did at James Madison University right with me.
Yes. Well, I was also a student of yours.
That is true. And I think
Yes.
we're going to talk about that in a couple of minutes because
Oh,
I
great.
was reviewing some of the things I sent to you along with the questions. And I'm like, oh, this was happening at about the time when you wrote this. So we will get to that soon. But for now, would you like to tell people what you do and your relationship with both resilience and with thriving, which is something that you teach?
That's right. And you put it in the present tense. And I like to point out that, well, I am retired, but I still feel that teacher role. I have dreams about it all the time. And there are plenty of opportunities that come up with strangers or friends or relatives where I'm doing volunteer work, where I'm in that feeling that I'm recalling my teacher, skills once again. So it's there. And my current research right now is to revise a book on crisis intervention that I had written, and it was published before the pandemic. And so we have so many, this is horrible to relate that we have so many incidents of mass violence in our society, as well as the pandemic, as well as natural disasters, hurricanes and fires and so forth, that I wanted to update the material in the book to be much more current and relevant. So that's what I've been doing now.
I am so glad that you're doing that because I have that book actually right here, my old copy, which anyone who's
Yay.
watching the video can see. The title of the book is Crisis Intervention. And yeah, so much has happened. And it feels to me like we have a crisis just about every other week. There's something else going on. And it can make your heart so heavy. What have you learned both from your research? And also, I just want to point out that, you know, while we were working together and beyond, you didn't just study this academically. You were out in the field working with people experiencing crises, like the firefighters who were, you know, taking care of people during 9/11, people who had
Right.
experienced hurricanes. You were working with landmine survivors in other countries. What have you learned from all of these people in your research about resilience and about dealing with crisis?
Well, I've learned so much, and it's been really a blessing to me to have those encounters over the years with landmine survivors. For example, when Ann Stewart and I went over to Beirut in Lebanon to work with landmine survivors, our focus was on resilience, was not to see these as poor, pitiful victims, but instead as resources, so that 28 of these participants came together for training so that they could go back to their villages and to their different countries in the Middle East and begin to design programs to assist other landmine survivors who come up in their community. And I can't remember a workshop that I laughed so much and had so much fun with. In addition to the pain, we weren't going to deny the horrific experiences they had. And I cried very often as they would tell their stories and share them in our group. And at the same time, they felt a powerful, powerful sense of community that they were sharing this with fellow survivors who had been strangers to them before this workshop. So I learned the power of storytelling, and I watched your previous episodes where you talk about storytelling a great deal, and the immense therapeutic power that stays with me. And I notice that I'm touching my heart as I do this because they did touch my heart.
And speaking of that, I remember when you went on that trip, and It may have been that trip or a different trip that had a similar theme, but I took a crisis intervention class with you soon after, and you had this exercise that you had people do where you had this heart. You remember the heart exercise? Could you share a little about that?
Well, I don't know. It varied in so many times. What was the version that you got?
I'm thinking back on it now, but we had to, I think, write down something that we were carrying with us that made us feel cared for or loved, so that we could be reminded in the midst of the tough things that we were going through that we were not alone. Does that ring a
Wonderful.
bell?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. That was one of the versions. So, and that reminds me that my wife's birthday was 2 days ago. And so I arranged for friends and relatives from all over the country to call her that day. And she wasn't aware that I was doing that. In fact, it was obvious that it was a surprise because when I sent all these messages to people, I forgot to put her phone number in it. And so then somebody asked for it, and I said, "Oh, well, you can tell that Mary Lou is not a part of this because she would have said, maybe you should put their phone number in, to make it complete." Anyway, I'm talking about this because when we went to visit our son and grandsons and a daughter-in-law who lived next door, they gave Mary Lou a card, a birthday card, and a gift. And our older grandson only speaks through his eyes. He's in a wheelchair and he has multiple challenges. But Mary Lou showed him the card and he loves to be read to. And so he turned the page. And so Mary Lou's reading the card to him. And she must have read it to him about 20 times. And he would keep turning the page, wanting for her to continue. And then she passed the baton to me and said, "Take over." And so I read it to him 20, 30 times. And the message stuck with me. And it was, "Happy birthday." And then our second grandson wrote in the card, "Happy birthday, Mimi." That's his name for her. Number 75. So it was like she's a football player or something, you know. And then it said, "May you be surrounded by all that brings you joy. May you be surrounded by all that brings you joy." And I can repeat it because I know it by heart
I'm sure you do.
after James taught me, over and over again. And that's exactly what we were talking about right here. And that exercise with the heart, what do you carry with you that brings you joy, that reminds you of your support?
Yes.
And that's where I have what I call triggers for resilience. And I know that you have trigger warnings in your material, which is wonderful. I also think we need to consider that we also have many objects or messages that remind us of resilience, who cares for us, and so forth. So that's what I have with me at all times.
I love that you said that. And I'm going to bring this with me to AWP, which is the Association for Writers and Writing Programs Conference, which I'll be speaking at in a couple of weeks. Because one of the pieces of feedback or wisdom that I received at a conference, this, I can't even remember who said it or how long ago it was, but they were talking about going back and writing about difficult material. And they said, don't go back alone. Carry a backpack filled with the things that fill you up and bring a flashlight so you know what you are illuminating or why you're going back. And I love that you had that. And I'm going to have to get that out because I still have all of those materials somewhere. Because it's such a
That's
great
sweet.
physical reminder
Yes.
that we are not just dealing with the difficult. We also have our loved. We also have people around, triggers that can support our resilience. And one of the things that I learned from your book, Crisis Intervention, that has stuck with me and it gave me language for an experience that I had is this concept of post-traumatic growth. And we talk a lot about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and trauma. But this was a game changer for me because it helped me know what I wanted to do as a writer. So could you define that for us?
Yes, that's it. Tedeschi and Calhoun are the two researchers who developed multiple studies. In fact, there have been studies done all over the world with survivors of different traumas and crises. And it's not immediate. We're not talking about right afterwards. It might even be 2 years later with follow-up studies where they and other researchers and ourselves, we did this with our landmine survivors too, and also found post-traumatic growth. And it's evidenced by a greater appreciation, a deep appreciation of life and what's going on, recalling a sense of wisdom and perspective that they bring to their encounters now, a deep sense of appreciation for everyday normal kinds of experiences that they can now savor with such tenderness, and then closer relationships with others in this fact. And so those are the highlights of post-traumatic growth. There are other aspects that people will often personalize. They're better able to cope with it. And I don't want to individualize it because it's part of being a community, part of a family or a family-like relationships that they have created with volunteers, relatives, neighbors, fellow members of their worship group, and therapists and counselors who have helped them to travel this journey not alone, but with others.
Absolutely. I think that community aspect is so important. And one thing that I read in the book, because I just was reading through that again, and also it was something that I've said in the past, is that for me, at least, post-traumatic growth is being able to look back at these really tough experiences and seeing the gifts in those experiences and being able to say, this was hard. This was something I wouldn't wish on anyone, and it was such a gift to my life. But I think one of the things we have to do in order to get there is to honor the very tough feelings we might have about a situation.
Exactly. And just because somebody might have now a post-traumatic growth doesn't mean that they didn't have post-traumatic stress disorder, too, that they can overlap tremendously. And part of the resilience that we have as human beings is being able to emerge from that hell and to then create a whole new heaven for us.
Yes, absolutely. And to that ability to be with yourself wherever you are. And I think one thing that can get in the way is toxic positivity, which you had re recently written something about on Facebook. And I can speak to my own experience of being a person who had had Lyme disease and who was sick for a number of years. I found myself being a victim of that in the beginning because A, I didn't want to be sick. And I felt like, well, if I just imagine my, recovery and if I just focus on like I'm going to get better at this certain time in this certain way, it will happen. And the reality was I was in a state of hell. I was absolutely miserable. And on top of the misery of the disease, I was experiencing shame and guilt, and I was stuffing my feelings about the disappointments I had about being sick at this time when I felt like my life was opening up for me. And I think it can cause so much damage. What have you learned about positive toxicity, and how are you personally working to combat that? Because not only are you this learned person who knows all of these things, you are a walk in your talk because you are also a cancer survivor.
That's right. Yes. And I had forgotten just how long that's been ongoing for me. I think the earliest diagnosis was about 2016. I was in treatment earlier, but they weren't definite about the diagnosis of cancer. But I found that the phrase toxic positivity is one that Mary Lou brought to my attention because as she's been dealing now with breast cancer and the treatment, that she found that so many times that people who were wanting to be, very supportive, but we're also saying, oh, you're so courageous and you're my hero, and just stay determined and keep positive. You can do it. I know you can. And they're acting more like cheerleaders than they were as friends who could also empathize and understand the anguish and pain and the fear that was engendered by the cancer, too. So that was one of the reasons why I've put that in the new edition of the crisis book, because that is something that I wanted to make sure that, because we might want to highlight the growth of somebody, that we don't ignore the pain too.
Yes.
And I tell my students, you empathize with the crisis, but you're curious about the survival and the potential for thriving that you're picking up as we go along. But you can't deny that this is so painful and difficult. And I think a lot of people do the cheerleading thing because it's easier to be off the field and to not have to deal with those kinds of painful feelings that are going on with somebody that you dearly love. Mary Lou's been a great mentor to me dealing with my cancer, of not doing any of that kind of toxic positivity. And I hope that I'm doing the same with her, of being a partner in this, but not being off the field as a cheerleader, denying that when she's going through a lot of pain.
Yes, because you're both dealing with cancer diagnoses.
Right, yes. And mine's, I'm hoping that I'm dealing with a form of cancer that my oncologist said there's no cure for your form of cancer, but we can manage it. And so that's our goal. And so I'm continuing on with some treatment and medication, as well as follow-up sessions. And so far, so good. My last appointment was very positive. And I find it wonderful to be celebrating that at the same time that we also honor the suffering that people are in too. And so
Yes.
that's when the positivity becomes toxic. So I don't want to take away people's hope for a better future. And there's a positive psychology movement and a lot of research that I find very fascinating, and it can be overdone.
Absolutely. And I love how you put it. Be with the pain, honor the pain, and be curious about the healing and the growth that can happen, but don't negate the pain. Yeah, and one thing I'm really sensitive to is what I call bright siding, which is one of the things you were talking about, which really is like, toxic positivity of like, oh, well, just think about the good things or be positive. But when you do that, you are especially if you do it to someone else, or even if you do it to yourself, you are unconsciously sending the message that the challenging feelings you have are not okay. And that's where the shame and the guilt comes from. And I think probably one of the best experiences that I had with you, where you were showing up with it all, was back in 2018, right before you wrote this article, which I'm going to put in the show notes. And I was teaching a class for James Madison University on writing to heal, and it was with a bunch of counselors and therapists and school counselors. And we were looking at different strategies people could use. And I had everyone do some writing exercises. And what you brought to the table was a story. It wasn't a story, it was really an essay because it was true, about an experience you had with your students because, you had this initial diagnosis or these treatments you were having in 2016, but in 2018, you got the diagnosis right before a class. And you were talking about what you did with that class, which I'm going to give you a chance to talk about in a second. And then we processed it again together, and there were tears and there was holding space. It was so beautiful. So could you talk about what happened?
Yes, it was a great experience for me. Well, first of all, it was a shock, because when there was this analysis done of a growth that they had taken off, and did a biopsy, and I was sure that, okay, they're going to find that, yeah, that's fine, it's benign, no worries. But instead, I got the word, this is malignant,
Yeah.
you need to be coming in for a treatment. of cancer. And reeling from that, I'm digressing, but this is for a reason. Every year, Mary Lou and I watch It's a Wonderful Life. And it's, the classic Christmas story, Jimmy Stewart, and Donna Reed. And George Bailey is considered the hero of this story, and he's dealing with a crisis in his own life, and then the whole community comes in to support him. Well, the reason was that his wife, Mary Bailey, was the one who contacted everybody to get them to come in to help him through his crisis. And that she is actually the hero of that story. It's not George Bailey. I mean, he's the beneficiary of it. And that's what I find going on oftentimes in people's lives, is that these other people make a difference. So that are off on the side. And when I'm working with somebody in crisis intervention, I'm often asking, who has been there for you in the past? Who has had your back? Ed McKee was the one who came up to me right before class. And this isn't in the article, but they wanted it shorter. And he said, I got a call from Mary Lou that you have had this diagnosis. And he was trying to whisper, but Ed McKee could never whisper. And I had the
No, he
door
could
open,
not.
actually, I had the door open to go into class. And he said, just know I've got your back. And then I go into class. I said, oh, thanks, Ed. That means a lot. And then students could hear him say, I've got your back. And then they also could see me being upset. And that's why I had that choice right at that moment. Well, do I just play it cool and not bringing this up? But I said, well, damn, this is a crisis intervention class. And I've got people who are in training to become counselors. I'm going to go ahead and share. And it was a powerful experience where they were incredibly supportive and empathic, did none of the toxic positivity. They were there for me, expressing their sense of their own shock and surprise, as well as their dedication to being there to have my back as well too. And it just taught me the power of teaching and being a student at the same time, that I was learning from my students what it means to actually go ahead and to ask for help. And here's this old crisis intervener who was doing that so long for others. Now it's being done to me, and I've got to show the grace of opening my heart up to that.
I always, every time I hear that story, I just love it because it takes so much vulnerability and trust to let people in. And yet, when we do, beautiful things happen because crisis often happens when we are alone, and we didn't choose it. We may not, there's so many things about it that can create this deep sense of loneliness and isolation, but it is in community that we heal. And I can already hear a question that some people are gonna have when they hear this. What if you are a person who feels like your heart has been broken so many times, you don't trust enough to let somebody in? What would you say to someone who has that experience?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would want to thank them for sharing that their heart has been broken and that they are so fearful of trusting, even telling that to me. And I want to honor that act of courage right there, because oftentimes the scariest step, and when people are dealing with counseling, is to actually make that appointment and come in and see somebody and begin to share what is so deep and dark in their hearts. And post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the descriptions in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, is being exposed to something that causes fear. And yes, that goes on, but there's also apprehension about being exposed to our shame. And that is something that even to ourselves, and that's where writing can become so powerful, is that I'm actually writing, and then I'm the reader reading what I just wrote about my shame that I thought I would all keep locked in forever. And there it is now on the screen or on the paper as part of my own self-exploration that's lurking in my consciousness on this side there.
Yes, and I love that, you know, the honoring of where people are at, and then the invitation that there's more. And writing can do so much for that, because when you write about your experiences, you externalize them. So that's the first thing that can happen, is it's not living inside you anymore. It lives on the page. And then through the revision process, or just even looking at it, you begin to organize it and help it make sense. And then you can look at what else. You know, that's something I really try to instill in people, is that whatever you write first is true. That's part of your experience, and you don't have to negate it or get rid of it. It's this and what else.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And what you just said brings up two important memories for me, is that Ann Stewart taught me to refrain from saying but. Instead, say and in these situations. And so, you know, empathize with the crisis and look for the survivor in that too. And also that we're involved in a process that's, one story doesn't do it.
Right.
Yeah, that story is true, but that's, and especially with crisis experiences, that there's this need to retell. And there's been research done on, like, after disasters, that when people share their stories right then and there, they're very chaotic and impressionistic and so emotional filled that it's often hard to put into words.
Yes.
And especially with kids, drawing it seems to be a better way to give their first draft of that story. And then people have a need to tell that story again and again and again and again. And each time they are at a different place. And each time it becomes true in a different way with their attentional spotlight on now other aspects that at first, you know, they didn't even realize.
Yes. I love all of that. And I think I use this book by Desmond Tutu and his daughter, Mpho Tutu, The Book of Forgiving. And it's this fourfold path for how to change the world. And it has these four stages that you go through in the process of forgiveness. And step one is tell the story. And what he says is tell it as many times as you need to, because just as you said, one telling isn't enough. And yes, that idea of it being chaotic in the beginning, for all the writers out there, your first draft is always going to be filled with chaos. But when you're dealing with crisis material, coming at it from a different medium, maybe drawing or collage or something else that allows you access to the images, can help you find the language that can help make this into something that's more cohesive. Because that's part of where the healing comes from, is not just that you wrote it down, but that you created something cohesive with it. And then you had a chance to say, okay, well, what else is there? I'm going to ask you a question, and I don't know is a perfect answer. I always say that when I haven't sent this question to somebody, but it's coming to mind. I work with a lot of writers who are working to publish, and some of them are in the earlier stages, and they are writing things that have been absolutely devastating, and they are working to create art from that. But something I see people do that I'm personally trying to figure out how to work with them on in a different way, so that we honor the pain, we also become curious about the survivors, that when people write what I call the victim narrative, and when I say victim, what I mean is just the narrative of powerlessness.
Yeah, sure.
And when you just keep revising that over and over again, just to make that part clearer, you reinforce that piece of the story, not just in your brain, but in your nervous system. And I wonder what your thoughts are based on your research and the work that you do, and also thoughts you have around how do we get out of that loop? I think it gets to be a different thing. There's the honoring of your story and being present with it, and then there's these loops that we can get into that are not necessarily serving us in the ways we might think.
Yes, yeah. And there is some new research that's coming out about neuroplasticity that shows that what can happen is that new neural pathways are created that can give us greater insight and make meaning from this process. And I take care to say make meaning, not find meaning, because
Yes.
we're not detectives looking for clues out there for the answer that's out there. Instead, we are resolved, and that's not being solving it, it's resolving that I will then explore inwardly. And that creates new neural pathways. Just the very act of putting it into words with writing or sharing it verbally or whatever, that I get concerned when I was doing more long-term counseling and therapy. If someone told the story identically again and again and again, and that is one where we do have to do some therapeutic intervention with to help them begin in ways that you were bringing up, to look at it from a different perspective or to set that aside and instead experience through art or as some other medium, in order to create neural pathways that they can then go back and take a look at what, you know, was hijacked, you know, by that process. And so it's one that, see, I'm giving you a long answer when I don't know all the answers to that, which is a classic professorial trick. But I think we're on our way towards discovering some important insights that's not going to minimize it or just reduce it to brain functioning, but instead oftentimes enrich it by our own ability to recognize, hey, you know, used to be an expression of saying, well, you know, that's pretty easy, that, you know, we're not talking about brain surgery. Well, when we're doing intervention of any sort with another person, we are doing brain surgery, because we often bring up our own experience as we hear their story in a way that's empathic and gets at those parts of the unconscious area that we're picking up by how they're saying this and what ways that they're presenting it to them as a presentation of self.
I think that there was so many good insights and also such good information, especially around this idea that we are not finding meaning out there. We are looking for meaning in here, you know, and it brings back this idea around toxic positivity that I was reading about this morning, this idea that we're looking for the silver lining, right? You don't have to look for the silver lining. You need to find the meaning inside yourself. And that is something that you can create regardless of what the experience is. And when you do this work, you do create those new neural pathways. This is brain surgery. You do this work, you're doing brain surgery on yourself.
Right.
Without a scalpel, thankfully.
Right. No kidding. Yeah. There's no blood, nothing else going on with this. And this is where I find it. I think you mentioned in our discussion before we started taping about my brother, Denny, who died. And I was curious about when this might broadcast, because my last conversation with him was 5 days before Valentine's Day. And he had just gotten back from Thailand. And this is where you might see some sources of my humor, because I asked him, well, how many Thais did you get? You know, that kind of thing. You know, it's really, we both enjoy those kind of stupid puns. And I was talking to him about his experience and what it was like and all the adventures he had. And it was wonderful. And he was living out near Seattle, and here we were in Virginia. And I, at the end, I began to learn a lesson that, hey, you might not have this moment again. So I said, instead of goodbye, which I always did before, I said, I love you. Denny. Well, those were my last words to him because, you know, he died 10 days later. So I found that to be so important for me that I take the time to look at every single opportunity where I might do an act of kindness or to show gratitude or to share my feelings of compassion and love for somebody. That's been a lesson I've taken with me. And so I've told that story a number of times, but each time I hope I tell it from a different place so that I am now someone who's had the experience of being, you know, a patient and who's been dealing with my partner who is dealing with a life-threatening illness and who wants to savor every moment of the chances to say, be kind.
So important. And, you know, the fact that we both lost brothers suddenly is something that's been a bond. You know,
yes, that's true.
That conversation you had, it sounds like it was on February the 9th. Is that correct? Or was it the February the 8th? You don't have to do the math.
It was pretty close to that. Yeah, because it was before Valentine's Day, February 14th. So yeah, February 9th sounds right. 8th could be.
Well, February 8th is the anniversary of my brother's death. And every time I hear that story, I think about the piece of post-traumatic growth that I learned. And it was something I had to really wrestle with was that, you know, before my brother died, we had been chatting on AOL. This was back in 1997 when, you know, all of this was brand new. And because it was brand new, it would go off a lot because we were on AOL and, you know, you'd get kicked off and try to get back on again and again. And we didn't get back on this last time. And there was something that said to me, like, you need to say, I love you. You need to say, I love you. Because we always did. And I had this thought, well, there'll be another time. And then, of course, there wasn't. And that was such a piece of guilt that I had because he died by suicide. And, you know, but also he taught me so much about how you have to make sure you listen to your body and you say these things and you do this. So it's for me anyway, what I would say is that I always try to make that a practice. But if I ever find like there's more to say or more to do, if I have this tug inside, right, that's like, no, you haven't done it enough or with this situation, I never hesitate to go back and say what else is on my mind and in my heart. And every time I hear you tell that story, which I've heard it several times and I love it every time, it reminds me of that gift that we give to other people and how, you know, even if we had a situation where we couldn't give it before, every time I say I love you to someone or I offer that kindness, I know it repairs that what happened before. You know, it's like I'm giving that gift, I'm paying it forward.
And there was research, I don't know if this is still the case, but I hope it is, that the profession that got the most were teachers, that they got Valentines. And in fact, there are far more Valentines expressing that kind of love than romantic love. And so I find that just very, very enriching to know that we're looking at all kinds of love at Valentine's Day, not just the romantic ones, and that there are so many people out there that would be touched by our communicating how much they mean to us.
Absolutely. So even though this is not going to air on Valentine's Day, which now I wish it could, but the schedule is the schedule.
Yes.
You can make Valentine's Day any day. So think about five people that you could send a Valentine to that are just people that you care about. You can send it anytime and you have no idea what meaning they'll make from that or how it will touch their day and how it will impact how they treat other people. So it's not just, you know, the one drop and you have hit a ripple to the next person, but it keeps going on, you know, further and further.
Yes. And that reminds me that I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you, Lisa, for the many, many ways that you helped my own healing. You recorded a guided imagery that I could listen to while I was dealing with chemotherapy and the infusion, and how it was so comforting. And comfort is a word I didn't use much before Denny's death. It's one that I find means a lot to me now, that it's not just superficial, that it's comforting to be reminded that I am not alone in this moment as poison is going through my veins to deal with the cancer that's threatening my life. And you were there for that, and your voice was there. And that meant so much to me to know that my former student is now part of my own learning lessons and healing. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm gonna cry now, and I'm gonna absorb that, and I'm not gonna deflect, right? I'm gonna take it in. Thank you. And also thank you for the gift of allowing me in. You know, sometimes people don't, and it was such an honor to me. Also, because when I was really sick with Lyme disease and feeling very, very alone, you were one of the people who would just contact me out of the blue and say, "How are you doing, Lisa?" You know, and that was such a gift, and I'm so grateful that I was also able to be a part of that, because I remember you would write to me like about the red one. I think there was the red one that was so terrible, and it was very meaningful to me that I was able to be a part of that. So thank you.
Oh, yes. And this reminds me of something else that train for the crisis intervention that you might have only a 10-minute or 15-minute or a couple hours encounter with somebody in crisis, and that may be the last time that you see them. So you want to do some place towards the end an expression of gratitude to them for taking the risk of sharing with you, perhaps a virtual stranger, this worst experience that they've had in their lives. And to show your gratitude by thanking them at that times. And I think that that's something that in our training of therapists, we've totally ignored is how the therapist can show gratitude. Because, the post-traumatic growth we've talked about, that there's been research on counselors and therapists vicariously experiencing post-traumatic stress, where they begin to take on their own symptoms by hearing these painful stories, horrific stories. And there's also research showing that we can experience vicarious post-traumatic growth by what we've experienced with somebody's resilience as they've shared their stories with us, that we can take away and feel be heartened by and enlightened by and inspired by.
And so what I would say to all the writers out there, because we have a lot of people on here who are writing, that one thing you can do when you are bearing witness to your own story is just say thank you to yourself for having the courage to come to the page. When you are working with a group of writers, like you're in a writing group and you're offering feedback, something I hear people say all the time is, "Oh, you're so courageous, you're brave." And that's fine. And yes, those things can be true, but you don't have to say them. Instead, say thank you for trusting me with your story, and thank you for trusting me and opening up. Just say thank you. That's all you have to say.
And it's wonderful for somebody who's feeling isolated and so shameful to hear themselves being thanked. What a gift that is, that I've somehow, some way generously offered something of value to another person, and that person's thanking me for being me, for being open about something. And I want to share something else with you here. This is something I'm reaching for something. This is what somebody
I love
gave
it.
me this. It's the desktop therapist. And she's a dear friend of Mary Lou's, and she sent her a gift, but she saw this and thought of me. So there's the little Freud looking like therapist here. And there's a button here that you can push, and it'll say some cliche. Like, I don't know if you heard that.
I heard noise. Can you say what it was saying?
Yeah, it says, "What do you think that means?" Well, I got this as a gift, and my grandson came over, Gabriel, and he said, "What is this?" And so the cliches started pouring out, you know, where the therapist said, "How does that make you feel?" And he goes, "Well, I feel okay about that, you know." And then one that he found so intriguing was, "Let's bring that back into the room, shall we?" So he thought that was so funny. What is that? So he'll now occasionally say that to me. You'll be talking about something else, or I'll pick him up at school, and he'll say, "Let's bring that back into the room, shall we?" You know, and the one that really got him irritated was, "What was your childhood like?"
Oh,
And he
that's too
says, "I'm
funny.
still in my childhood." So anyway, the scripted cliches on here are funny, and we ought to set those aside, and instead
Yes.
speak from the heart. Even if we have difficulty expressing something, and even noting that, saying, "I'm feeling myself choking up," or like you said very touchingly, "You know, I'm going to be crying." All of those are ways that we can really open up our shared humanity in ways that really can be so powerfully therapeutic. And when you're writing, that's something that you can talk about being a meta writer. As I write this, I'm finding that this is going on for me, and to be writing that as well too, as a way. And Pennebaker is a social psychologist who did research on the therapy of writing, who found that in these classical studies, you know, where one group is randomly assigned to write about the worst thing that ever happened in their lives, and the others are randomly assigned to just write about day-to-day mundane things, that the ones who wrote about, you know, their traumas, their disappointments, their crises, then 6 months later, their health was much better, and they're less likely to have gone to the college health center, and in so many other ways, by dealing with that is therapeutic in and of itself, of putting that into words.
Absolutely. It takes the chaos of experience and creates sense around it. And yes, I've read Pennebaker's books. I love what he has to say. I always also do like to couch this because in the writing community, his work is mentioned a lot. And all of his studies were for people who were writing, and then they did not read it again, and it was never for public consumption. So I think that's always something I want to say
Yeah,
about
that's
his
right.
work, because sometimes people will think that, oh, well, if I just write it and then I share it out in the world, I'm going to have the same experience that all of Pennebaker's test subjects had. And that is not necessarily the case.
That's a great
So,
point. Yeah.
yeah, thinking about writing to heal versus, writing for public consumption is so important. And that's something that I talked with Laura Davis about, who is the author of The Courage to Heal for season one. So by the time this airs, people can go back and listen to that episode as well. But yes, I think it's so important. And as we wrap up, I always ask people a series of questions. And the first one I always ask is, what is the best writing advice you've ever received?
That I've ever received is, let's see, I think it's not so much advice as it is, it wasn't taught, I caught it. So the contagiousness of the love of the word is something I've caught. I have a dear friend of mine who sends me regularly. I get emails from him pretty much every day, in which he will often share a sentence that he came across that he just loved and he wanted to share it with somebody. So he sends it to me. And that enthusiasm that he has been contagious for me in my writing right now, which sometimes can get a little tedious, and that I have to really get myself psyched up to return to this project that's been ongoing for a long time now. And so it's not so much advice that, was taught to me as that the emotion that was I caught from the contagionness of his enthusiasm.
I love that. And I want to share the best piece of writing advice that you gave to me, which is a good EDS is a done EDS. And I translate this to my clients' work all the time, and I'll say, a done draft is a good draft.
There you
And
go.
sometimes just get to that point, and that's how we make progress. How do you nourish and nurture your resilience?
I find that as a grandparent, I and living next door to my grandkids, that cuddling up to James, who has no words but the most soulful eyes, and when we connect eye to eye, I feel like it's heart to heart. And he, in his wheelchair, will dance like this, back and forth, with his arms, and will play hide and seek with me sometimes, where he'll hide his face and then he'll show it to me, and then we'll do a peekaboo thing. That all of that are ways that I find I'm just celebrating life. And then our other grandson, I pick him up from school and he comes to our home to do his homework. And he inspires me all the time with things such as he has spelling words, and I remember having spelling words, 18 of them he has every week. On one day, he's got to write them alphabetically, and another week, or another day of the week, he's got to do a synonym, another day, an antonym. And on the fourth day, he's supposed to write a sentence with each of those 18 words. Well, he decided, and I think this is good advice for your writers, is that he decided to make a story connecting all those sentences.
Oh my
So
gosh.
for example, I remember two words he had were bridge and gravity. And so he started this story, said, "London Bridge is falling down." And the next sentence was, "And it's not because of gravity, it's because the Germans bombed it." And so then he goes on to this fantastic story where he's playing with history and making it fictional as he ties together these words. So I find it. And then, Mary Lou is always doing things that make me laugh and that I feel connected to her in such a deep way. And we've been married for over 54 years now. And it seems that you mentioned earlier how, long ago our first relationship was, and how it seems like yesterday. And that's how it feels like with me, that I can share things with her that nobody else would get that in joke except for her. And that's a relationship that's a special heart-to-heart bond that I know that you have in your life too, that feels just so much, gives me more resilience just to know I'm loved by lots of people.
And you are very loved by lots and lots of people. I can attest to that. Everyone I know who knows you loves you. That's you've just given so much, and now everybody is like, oh, Lenny, I love him so much. And I'm so glad that you did. It's true. And I'm so glad that you have that in your life and that you pay attention to it. Part of resilience is about where we place our focus. And again, like we've talked about the whole time, it's not ignoring the tough stuff, but it's also saying, and these other things are happening because, I remember you writing to me in the midst of this chemo treatment where you had just awful side effects at times. Your grandsons would also do these wonderful things for you, and they would say all of these very cute things. I always love hearing about them. And that would make your day, and it would make it more tolerable, easier to deal with the tough stuff that you were also enduring. So it wasn't an ignoring of that, but that where you place your focus can be so important. And it works in writing too. where you place your focus on the page and on the situation can have a profound impact on your readers, but also on you as the writer and those neural pathways that you are building in your brain.
And I'd like to mention something else that for me, writing isn't just something for publication. Writing can be a silly poem that I write to a member of the family, or writing can be the annual Christmas newsletter that we send out. That this is a 30-second edition of that.
Oh my gosh.
Where we
seconds.
have parodies of whatever's happening in the news. It's called the North Pole Inquirer. And so we're talking about the Grinch often, and Frosty and Santa and reindeer. All of those come into play here. I think in the most recent one, I had Santa decided that his naughty and nice list was getting too complicated. So he had artificial intelligence take over, and it decided that only robots were nice enough to be on the list. And all the human boys and girls were taken off because, the bar was so low for them. So I have found that I want to picture in my mind the reader when I'm doing these things as a way of saying, here's what I'd like to share with you that's silly and goofy and also feels heartfelt that I wanted to share with you.
Yes, and I think that's so important because, I work with a lot of writers and they think that everything has to be for, we'll call it publication. I'm putting that in quotation marks for those of you who can't see it, in the sense that it's going to go to a literary journal or it's going to get a publisher or, it's going to become a book. But sometimes writing for the joy of writing and the joy of connection and the fun of it can be so helpful. And I have another book here that you wrote, which I find to be absolutely delightful. And that I'm holding up right now
oh
is
my
Good
gosh.
Night Yume, which is a play on the classic Goodnight Moon. And it's so fun to read. And, it's such a nice counterbalance to some of the headier academic work you do and the work you do in crisis and dealing with trauma and writing about that is like this fun little book. It has a bunny character who is Jung, and you can look it up online. It's very fun. So I love that you bring that up because I think bringing joy into the process is so important. And it's such a nice balance to maybe some of the heavier work that we do. Well, if people want to learn more about you or they want to continue this conversation with you, what is the best way for them to connect?
Email is fine for me, and you can post that on your notes there. And I'd love to hear from people. By the way, I just sent that book to a former student, doctoral student,
Oh, nice.
who just had a baby. Her baby's newborn, but got a taste of the Jung in there.
Nice.
And one of my former students was from Bulgaria, and I had to try to find a way to rhyme Rogerian.
Oh.
And Bulgarian was the one I came up with. So she thought I was writing it, to her. That's an easy way to connect with me.
Yeah. And so Lenny's email address will be in the show notes. And also for those of you who might be thinking like, who is Jung and what are you talking about with Rogerian? Carl Jung did psychoanalysis. And so he is a prominent person in the field of psychology. And so is Carl Rogers. I want to thank you so much for being on the podcast today. It was such a joy to talk with you. Thank you so much, Lenny.
My pleasure. This has been wonderful to reconnect. Thank you so much.
Are you a writer who struggles with doubts? Do you wonder if your stories are good enough? Do you wish you had some simple tricks that would make the writing life just a little bit easier? Become part of my Writing and Resilience community by signing up for my newsletter. As a thank you, you'll receive a free copy of Write More, Fret Less, 5 brain hacks that will supercharge your productivity, creativity, and confidence. The link is in the show notes. That's it for today's episode. Before you leave, I would love your help spreading the word about this podcast. You can do this in a few very simple ways. Click on the subscribe button in the upper right-hand corner, then leave a 5-star review. You can also let me know what you think or share ideas for the podcast by connecting with me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or through my Writing Your Resilience newsletter, which you can have delivered directly to your inbox.